When the TV series Mad Men drew to a close last season, there were big changes in store for the advertising agency Sterling Cooper. The most powerful people at the agency, Don Draper, Roger Sterling, and Burt Cooper, had hatched a plan to break away from their British parent company to start their own firm. They sought help from British executive Lane Price, the only person with the authority to sever their contracts. Here's a scene from the last episode of last season. Price is with Draper, Sterling, and Cooper going over their plan.
If I were to send a telex in at noon today that you've all been sacked, it's after close of business in London. It would remain unnoticed until Monday morning there, 2 a.m. here. That gives us today and the weekend to first gather accounts and then a skeleton staff to service them. And, of course, we would have to obtain all the materials required for continuity of service.
Obtain? We have to steal everything.
Anyone approached must be a certainty. If news spreads, they'll lock us out.
Did we vote or something?
Well, gentlemen, I suppose you're fired.
Well, it's official. Friday, December 13th, 1963. Four guys shot their own legs off.
The British executive Lane Price, who helps mastermind the breakaway, is played by Jared Harris. He's the son of the late actor Richard Harris, who, in between his roles playing kings and aristocrats, had the 1968 hit of Jimmy Webb's MacArthur Park. And Jared Harris's stepfather was Rex Harrison. Before being cast in Mad Men, Jared Harris's film roles included I Shot Andy Warhol, Happiness, and The Other Boleyn Girl. And he had a recurring role in the FX series The Riches. Terry spoke to Harris in 2001. Since we've been on the topic of MacArthur Park, let's begin our interview excerpt there.
What did you think of the record when it came out, and what was happening in your life that year, 1968?
During my first year in a prisoner of war camp that was a private school called Lady Cross.
It was like a high school?
Yeah, it was a boarding school.
So everybody in the school must have known this. Did this help or hurt your reputation?
I remember seeing him on Top of the Pops singing My Boy, but not that one.
Well, I guess it wasn't that big in England, huh?
No, it was, but it wasn't, I was at a boarding school, you know, you didn't have radios, you weren't allowed to watch television, you didn't have access to you know, where would you hear it? You didn't have little record players or CDs or anything like that.
Well, when you saw your father and your stepfather acting, was it acting or the actor's life that you found appealing?
I wasn't aware of my dad being an actor when I was young. There was an Australian children's entertainer on television called Rolf Harris, and when I'd say my father was an actor, the kids would say, you know, oh, is he Rolf Harris? I'd say no, and then they would lose interest. So I was disappointed he wasn't Rolf Harris for a long time. But I wasn't aware of him as an actor. I had the benefit of both his success and my stepfather's success in being privileged to go and see a lot of the world when I was very young, you know. So that rubbed off, a taste for that rubbed off, definitely.
What were the Richard Harris and Rex Harrison movies that made the biggest impression on you when you were young?
I remember seeing Camelot. I do remember seeing Camelot and a film called The Snow Goose.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the first films he made that kids could go and see. My father mostly was in mature themed movies. Rex, I remember seeing him in Cleopatra. He played Caesar. opposite.
That must have been fun.
Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, I loved Cleopatra was great fun with all these battles and everything.
When you started acting, did you feel that there was anything you had to live up to from your father and stepfather's reputation, or that you would be compared to them in any way?
Well, obviously compared myself. It was important to me to establish myself on my own terms. I had opportunities to act with him very early on in the movie The Field. They had trouble finding somebody, and I was talking to the director about playing his son in The Field, and he was leery of it, and so was I. And it was important to me for me to be established and recognized on my own right before I went and you know, I guess, went down that route, you know, tried to coattail, you know. I didn't want to do that. Otherwise, you know, I wanted to fail on my own terms. If I was used, you don't know if you got, everybody has to think that they've got something special to get into this, because the chances of succeeding are so slim. If I had nothing special and I was going to fail, then I wanted to do it on my own terms and rather than sort of be fooled, you know.
Was there anything that you'd seen in your father or stepfather's careers that either influenced you or convinced you to do it differently?
Well, Rex had, and my father still has, incredibly successful, varied careers. So I'd be thrilled if I could get mine up to that kind of a level. I think the lesson that I remind myself is it's not giving up. You know, they didn't want Rex Harrison to play the part of Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady when they were going to make the movie. They didn't want him for it. He'd played it on Broadway and he'd played it in the West End. But he wasn't a movie star. And so they were going to get somebody else. And they, of course, were campaigning for him to play this part. And so they demanded that he audition for it and send a photograph of himself in, you know. And they were trying to, you know, they put him through some fairly humiliating, or attempted to put him through some humiliating hoops to get this part. And he sent a photo of himself straddling over one of those little fountain, you know, those boys that piss into a fountain, you know. And he sent that in as his picture. They didn't want my father for the role in Camelot either, to play King Arthur. They wanted Richard Burton, and when he turned it down, they were going elsewhere, and he campaigned like hell to get that part. I mean, even to the point of tracking down Jack Warner in some party out in Palm Springs to convince him to give him a shot at this role, you know? So those are the things that I remember. When you see something that you know you're right for, go after it, and not to give up while you still have the desire and the ambition.
The movie that I think you first became really known for was I Shot Andy Warhol in 1996. And this movie is about Valerie Solanas, who wrote the Scum Manifesto and actually shot Andy Warhol, seriously wounding him and nearly killing him. Lily Taylor played Valerie Solanas. You played Andy Warhol. How did you get the part?
I auditioned. I knew it was a part that they would cast an English-speaking actor, I mean, an English actor for. Generally, when you're over here, if you're English, you tend to get the parts that, this just sounds a bit silly, not that nobody wants, but, you know, you get the kind of odd parts, the character parts, or the sort of the kind of the villain parts. So I knew this was an American role, which was an important thing for a foreign actor working this country to get, is to try and get your first American roles, you know. So I was all gung-ho to try and land this part, and played some little mind games to get it.
What did you do for the audition?
You know, I went in and met them first, and I had a beard and everything, and I deliberately tried to look as unlike the guy as I could, and then said I'd like to come in. don't ask me to come back in 2 days' time or 3 days' time. I said, give me 2 weeks or 3 weeks to really focus on this and try and get it right, and you'll have an idea of how close I can get. And and if you've got any material, the tapes and stuff like that, then I'd love to get that, because that'll give me a cut short my that process. So, which is what I did. I studied for a couple of weeks, and I came into the audition, and I thought it would be too weird if I sat down talking as I do now and then suddenly put on this persona. So I went in and did the whole thing as Andy. And then I thought, well, he would do something to try and flip the tables on these people, because he didn't like to be put on... he liked to be in the spotlight, but not having it pointing at him. He liked to be pointing the spotlight. So I was trying to figure out how to turn the tables, and I got hold of a little video camera and made a movie of them auditioning me.
Now, you play Andy Warhol as if he's pretty disconnected from his body, and almost as if his body doesn't have much weight or energy.
I thought that's true, looking at the photos of him and seeing him move around. I think he'd become pretty disappointed in his sexual experiences, and I think he hated the way he looked, and he hated his body. He didn't like the way it looked. That was before he got shot. I think he's deteriorated greatly after he got shot. But I also noticed that in all of his pictures, he always covered up his crotch.
Huh.
You always see him the way he stands. He's always sort of covering it up.
Gee, what does that mean to you?
I think that he was uncomfortable and was disappointed in the act of sex, and was in some way disappointed in his physical being, you know.
Now, I think of you as being a real chameleon in some of your movies, and I think it's great for you as an actor. I think the only problem would be that people don't necessarily recognize you from role to role, and therefore it might be a little harder to build up a reputation for being Jared Harris.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's been a problem.
Absolutely. Good for the craft, crap for the career. it is. In this country, a good actor is confused with a famous actor.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that's made it a longer journey.
Jared Harris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Is that the end?
Yes, it is.
I've enjoyed it. Time just flew by.
Jared Harris speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2001. Harris plays the British ad executive Lane Price in the AMC series Mad Men. Its fourth season begins Sunday. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. We're closing with music from Dutch saxophonist and bandleader Willem Bruyker, who's died at the age of 65. For years, he led the Willem Bruyker Collective. This was recorded in 1987. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.